Hello and welcome to the AIPT Comics Podcast, episode 345. My name is Dave Brooke. I'm here with Chris Copeland for the third week in a row. Alex is taking a sabbatical. We can't tell you why, but he may have superpowers when he returns.
I never get superpowers when I have to leave.
Well, that's because you go in the bucket. Or is it
barrel? The barrel. I just go in the barrel. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, maybe I'll irradiate the barrel. I don't know.
Ooh, yeah. Well, you know, I just found out my water here in Massachusetts is polluted, and even if you shower in it, you might get powers. So I'm hoping optic blasts, maybe like super metal skin.
Is the power an early demise? Is that a superpower?
Yeah, in real life, that's what gamma rays do.
Commune with the dead?
I always like to start the show by asking you a question that you don't see coming. So, Chris, let me ask you, how many times a day do you give your cute little kitty and doggy a kiss on the forehead?
Probably 3 to 4 each, like easily.
A day?
I call it boop and snoots.
Okay, so those are rookie numbers. We're going to need to get those numbers up by the end of the show, okay? If I don't hear a smooch during recording, you're in trouble.
I will pick up both animals and boop their snoots.
Dude, you got to double fist your pets.
No, they hate each other. I can't do that. I'll just get clawed and stretched. And yeah, they do not get along.
It'd be a lot like that scene in the Superman movie where Superman's dad's like, don't save me from the tornado. Don't. I don't want people to know your powers.
You should have saved him.
Probably one of the greatest scenes of all cinema. Anywho. We're going to recap the biggest news of the week. We're going to review our favorite comics. And this week, we have very special guests, Jacob Phillips and Tate Bromble, on to talk about Everything Dead and Dying number 1. It came out this week. We'll talk about the series in general. It's a zombie book. It has a really good hook. Tate talks about how he's had that hook in the back of his mind for years. And Jacob talks about his craft as well. There's a really fun anecdote in there about his dad, Sean. Check it out. It's a really good listen. But before we jump from this, Chris got to interview them for the website a few weeks ago. Came out great.
All of my interviews come out great.
Now, speaking of those,
I'm a golden god.
You are, I think it's 25 interviews deep on deep dives that are like 4,000 to 5,000 words. Where
I think it's 17 this year. Oh, so 17. 25 last year. Yes.
Oh, okay.
I keep track of these numbers for
guys, you got to go check these out. Go find Chris. I'll actually put the link in the podcast post for this. Read those interviews because they're really good background on the creators themselves, but also the works they're doing. Multiple works per interview. Gives you a really good sense of who they are. Chris is a great interviewer, too. I got to listen to one a few weeks ago. You did, too. Anywho, let's break down the news. Starting with, I always say it, the news that everyone's talking about. And that is Marvel's Stormbreakers unleashing new costumes for their favorite heroes. Boy, howdy, this came out on Thursday. People were losing their goddamn minds about how cool these costumes are. You might remember the Stormbreakers, I think a year, maybe 2 years ago now, they did a Sidekicks variant month. And those Sidekicks ended up becoming real characters. Maybe these costumes might come to life at some point, too. There's some sick ones in here. Chris, do you have a favorite?
You know, I was going to say it was going to be the Moon Knight, just because I like the black and white contrast, but the more I look at the Wolverine power shoulders, that open chest. It needs is a gold chain, and I think we're onto a winning combination.
Yeah, team him up with Power Man in the 60s.
Yeah.
I really like the Ghost Rider one. The bike looks sick. The suit's cool. It's a different kind of like racer suit that we haven't seen Ghost Rider wear before, I think.
Yeah.
The Human Torch one's odd. He's got like a like armor on his shoulder.
Yeah, it makes him kind of look more, I don't know, chaotic, which I like.
His hair is good. The hair is cool, yeah.
The only one that I think kind of underwhelms me is Cap, which you can't really improve that costume now. I think it's pretty solid, but
yeah, the star the A on his head is bigger. Go check these out on AIPTComics.com, of course. He's also got knee pads that are pretty cool. The Daredevil one
is the knee pads.
It's all the knee pads.
It's always the knee pads.
The Daredevil one's just super cool. I can totally see this one working in the comics. He's got a cool little jacket. Like, he belongs on the Thunderbolts. He belongs on the new Warriors. Warrior!
Get him on any team, baby. When you look like that, you're money.
The Spider-Woman, you know, I was thinking people were going to react to the Spider-Woman like, oh my god, exploitation. Because it's a crotch shot in this, which is a little surprising. But it's not like gratuitous, which is cool.
Wolverine is you know, blasting full chest, so you know, it feels a little equal opportunity. But yeah, I assumed there'd be some kind of blowback from Spider-Woman, but
I'm gonna try to say that character is blasting full chest the next time I watch a movie with someone. Moving on to our next bit of news, Black Panther is returning in a big way, sort of. fans are moderately interested slash annoyed that he's not getting an ongoing, but earlier Friday, Victor LaValle and Stefano Nessi are taking on Black Panther Intergalactic, a four-issue limited series. It seems, you know, Imperial was a four-issue limited series. I almost feel like Marvel's, like, testing the waters for these cosmic books. They're all miniseries. None of them are ongoing. Although, maybe She-Hulk could be ongoing. I forget if they've announced
that. I think She-Hulk was at least intended when they first announced it, I think, was ongoing. But, yeah, everything else has been miniseries, which, you know, I don't think you can blame them.
Yeah.
It's a smart enough choice.
Mm-hmm. That is also the Black Panther book is, of course, spinning out of the Imperial War Black Panther one-shot. And T'Challa is clearing Wakanda's name after being framed for a galaxy-shaking assassination, which, of course, happened in Imperial No. 1. I like Black Panther as a space character.
Yeah, I think it works. And I like that they're just making him the focus, because they think there's so much going on with just, like, cosmic stuff that having like, a more earthy kind of character move into this space just helps.
Right.
At least it has helped me kind of, like, track everything.
And the concept of Wakandan space, like intergalactic, I don't know, it's really interesting. Also interesting, Marvel has revealed the solicitations for their Ultimate titles out in December, and we've got info on Ultimate Endgame number 1, which I think we already got for this one, but we got new cover art to check out as well. Check that out on amptcomics.com. Ultimate Spider-Man number 24 is the last issue of the series. Marco Cicchetto and Jonathan Hickman are finishing it off, which can only mean one thing. And this is my call out right here. I never remember my call out. So when it happens,
I'll remember it for you.
Listeners, remember for me. But Ultimate Endgame, Spider-Man is dying in the end of the issue. It's going to be the big conclusion twist cliffhanger thingy. Maker's going to break his neck. Richard's going to take over. It's going to be the ultimate. No, because look, they killed Spider-Man in like the first year of the original Ultimate line.
It would be ballsy to like double down and repeat that move, but I kind of hope you're right now.
I love how much ass is in the Ultimate Wolverine cover as well. Lots of ass.
There is blasting full booty.
It's interesting this very Russian focused title with the world the way it is these days.
Yes, it is an interesting storyline choice. But
anything you're excited for?
I mean, I think Endgame is going to be interesting, obviously. Yeah. That's not exactly a controversial opinion, but I'm really excited to see kind of how it'll actually unfold. And I like that it's, oddly enough, kind of coming at or near the end of the year. It just feels fitting for a big event,
mm-hmm.
a big thing.
Yeah, it's a lot going on in December for Ultimate fans. Moving on to some more Marvel, wait a minute, on the sheet it says IDW news. That's because IDW and Act 4 have been teamed up to put out these new collections that are preserving the original pencils of artists, and Steve Ditko's Amazing Spider-Man is getting the Act 4 edition in 2026. It's an oversized 15x22 collection. It's a little different than other things, but you know what's funny? I have something like six collections of Amazing Spider-Man number 1 through like 100 or whatever in different formats. I have like the Taschen one that's like I don't know, 50 inches by like 40 inches.
It's 7 feet tall.
I've got the new Penguin pounds. One that has a new introduction. I've got the Epic that is like, dude, literally this thick. It's like the thickest Epic ever made.
Two bricks stacked on top of each other. Yeah, no, I've seen it.
But this is a little different. So it's a different kind of taste.
I do love that they're doing, like, they're putting an emphasis on, like, maintaining the integrity of the pencil work. I think that's if all of these are just, like, a gimmick to sell the same things over and over again, that, to me, is, like, the most exciting kind of gimmick.
Right, right. It'd be like if and a journalist who does incredible long form interviews were to repackage those into a print version and then a newspaper version and then maybe a Gatchaman version where you read it after you feed your pet.
Wow. That one I'm actually interested in.
You know what I'm interested in? Sonic, Supersonic Monthly, a new column at AFETcomics.com. Look at that. It's become an ad.
We're in the news.
Yeah, so AIPT and Sega and IDW are all teaming up on a monthly fan question and answer column that is all about IDW's Sonic line. But because Sega's involved, I believe there might be some Sega kind of stuff going on. We'll see. Time will tell. It only just started. We have been collecting questions from fans since Wednesday. You can go on aptcomics.com and ask your questions. There's still time to do so about the IDW series. They also have just launched a new story arc this week in the Sonic comics. And yeah, it's joining X-Men Monday, Venom Unleashed, TMNT Tuesday. These columns that allow fans a closer interaction with creators and editors.
I think this one made me go back and do a little more research into what's going on in the Sonic comics. And I, you know, obviously our other titles, you know, Godzilla, especially, I think shows how just robust that is. And so I hope that this one just lets everybody know that there's some really cool stuff going on kind of in the Sonic comics and that, mm-hmm. you know, it was a, you know, bit of a blind area for me, but I think it's cool. I like all these, you know, columns that we get to do. I think it's important.
Yeah, and this one, it's a little more like middle to high school aged kind of comic style, definitely. I would say, which is great. And that gives, you know, our growing columns in collaboration with licensed characters the different flavor, I think. And yeah, and Sonic fans are a very interesting group.
They are very interesting.
Very passionate. Moving on to some more IDW news. TMNT 13... is taking the cake for a theme this week, and you'll realize that in a minute. Blind bags, baby, they're everywhere. I think we talked about this last week or the week before.
We did. I think we've talked at least once or twice in the last month or so about blind bags and just how it's literally overnight. It just seems like everybody's doing them.
So a couple months ago, Battle Beast number one came out with a blind bag. Wasn't super overpriced. Essentially what it is, it's they polybag the comic and you don't know what variant cover you're going to get. So there's a chance you could get like a rare one or whatever. And it was a huge success for Image with Battle Beast. They sold like hotcakes. And then this week, Batman number one came out. They did the blind bags. They were a lot pricier. I've heard on the street that because they're so pricey, fans are not so much picking those up. But it's the same concept. That's just one anecdote, by the way. Could be selling well for all I know.
There was something on some story somewhere that somebody put up one of those Batman number one blind bags for like $1,200 or $1,300.
Whoo, baby.
Yeah, which that's wild. All right. It's starting.
And we know that Marvel's gonna be doing it with Ultimate Endgame, which we were just talking about. And TMNT 13, which is launching a new creative team with Gene Luen Yang and Freddie E. Williams II, will be getting the blind bag treatment. You could check out the covers on AIPTcomics.com. I don't think they told us the price. Oh, yes, we did. They're only $4.99 each, which I believe is what Battle Beast was.
Yeah, I think so.
They're like a buck more than what you would spend on usually for the comic. So I could see these doing well. There's some really good covers here too. I mean, the Clayton Crane cover is just insane. It's
pretty great. Yeah.
It's so cool. But yeah, we're going to keep track of the blind bag extravaganza.
This trend, you know, I hope it, I guess of all the trends that have happened maybe over the last 5 years, this one, at least it's hokey and gimmicky a little bit, but I mean, at least people are trying to buy it for the actual art and not something like perceived or that doesn't feel as weighty. I'm still not 100% about it, but I do think, all right, yeah, if we're gonna, you know, play into trends, might as well be this one.
I want to see blind bags in other areas. I want to see, like, you go to the museum and you can only enter a room and see a painting if you pay the additional price, and you might see a rare Picasso never seen before,
or you might see like a child's squiggly drawing from like a fridge. Yeah.
I just paid $100 for that.
Let's gamble. Let's do it.
That's what it is, essentially. In blind bag news, Dynamite also is updating fans. They have a Kickstarter going for Vampirella right now, and they let fans know that their blind bags in the Kickstarter, no less, are going to go up in price once the Kickstarter is done. Interesting incentivizing things. So
yeah, kind of smart.
One of the blind bags. So one of the tiers is a Vampirella blind bag. It's $100 right now, and it's going to go up to $125 if you don't get it in the Kickstarter. That's a different tactic that we haven't seen yet. But
yeah,
it's probably going
to
work out for
us. It's interesting to see publishers kind of try and figure this thing out in real time and like,
yeah, true.
What's going to work, what's not. And then they get some pretty immediate feedback, especially I think, you know, like you mentioned with Batman, like people were a little hesitant about the price tag. So,
yeah. Well, what's crazy is we actually have someone on the line right now, Bob Fink. He owns Blind Bag Inc. It's a company that specializes in doing blind bags for companies.
Wow.
Fink, are you there? Oh, shoot. I think we lost him.
I think we lost him. You know, he might be busy because he handbags every comic.
Yeah, he uses like a soldering thing to get the bag closed.
Yeah,
the
plastic. To seal it perfectly.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
it's hours and hours of work every day.
And judging by how many burns I saw on his hands when we talked earlier, it's very serious work.
Yeah, his hands are 3 inches deep with bandages from the burns, from soldering burns.
If life was a blind bag, this next bit of news definitely surprised me.
Did you get your money's worth?
I did on that joke. Popeye is setting sail with I Hate Fairyland in a crossover. Popeye is copyright free. What is the term? You know what I mean?
Public domain.
David? Thank you. And why not have an adventure with this I Hate Fairyland character by Scotty Young? There's a couple covers on Amputee you can check out. I just think this is great. I think we need what's his name? Pooh Bear to be showing up maybe in a Marvel comic. Maybe he fights.
Is Pooh in the public domain already?
Yeah, I think he is. I think, yeah. Isn't he?
Let me see. I know, like, this year it was like Popeye and Tintin and.
Yeah, he
a couple
is.
Others.
Yeah, right, there's one. There's a crappy Winnie the Pooh horror movie where he kills everyone with a honeypot.
Oh, that's right.
I think there's like naked people in it too for some reason. It's like makes no sense. In our last bit of indie comics news, Liam Sharp is taking over on Spawn the Dark Ages, which is a character we haven't seen in quite some time. And knowing Liam Sharp and his new art style, that's like just unreal. This is going to rule. It is a miniseries, and, you know, like, Medieval Spawn was a character, like, it's one of those characters that the design itself is just like, yeah, let me go read that. It may not have the deepest stories, I can't say for certain, because I haven't read them all, but it just lives and breathes on the cool design, and who else to give this to than Liam Sharp?
If we're going to do this, I think Sharp is probably the best. I feel like Spawn is having kind of like a heyday again, and you know, I really enjoyed Bloodletter, so that's been
good.
So I'd love to see what Sharp does with this, but yeah, I mean, just based on the preview art, I think it's exactly what I want it to be, which is just really intense.
And honestly, it's just like Bloodletter. It seems like Todd McFarlane is giving creators a little more like line to work on these things.
Yeah,
for the longest time, he was like co-writer, and I think it stifled the stories a little bit.
Yeah, when I talked to the Bloodletter team, they had mentioned something that about Todd being very like not hands off, but I think he's definitely giving people a little more kind of leeway and you know. Saying, well, I wouldn't have picked you for this job if I didn't think you could do it, and then letting them actually do it. So
Todd McFarlane, soon to be TV star on Dracula.
I think he lives near me.
Does he really?
Well, yeah, I think he lives somewhere in like southwestish Phoenix.
All right.
So
get in your car. Just slowly drive around.
Todd!
Is it Todd-father? Todd-father!
Todd-father!
Moving on to more news that made people shout and cry. Comics Legends are teasing and helping support the sequel to Superman, Man of Tomorrow with awesome art. James Gunn leading the charge with social posts from artists Jorge Jimenez, Jim Lee, and Mitch Durett. Ever heard of them? Anyway, the art all has one thing in common. It features Lex Luthor in his iconic green super suit or mech suit and Superman by his side. In one, they're fighting. In two, it looks like Superman's helping him build the suit. That's one. That one's by Jim Lee. And in another one, they both seem to be fighting something. It's gotten everyone speculating. Is Lex Luthor and him going to team up? I don't know. We'll see. Nicholas Holt and other actors also tweeted out this art. But it's so freaking cool to see comic book art being used to promote the movies.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, I think there's like a bad history of comics creators, artists not getting kind of paid or their fair bit of the spotlight. But, you know, I think Gunn has gone out of his way to try and give more credence that he's really reliant on the comics, the stories for what he's doing. And it's nice to see. And also it's just fun. I just think this is definitely my favorite kind of iteration of Lex Luthor. So I'm excited to see it translate.
Totally. And by the way Superman ended, I'm like, how are they ever going to pull this off? But I don't know, maybe it's another universe or something.
Yeah, who knows?
This is a good way to take movie money and give it to artists, too. Like, hey, want to do a promo?
Just do that.
I'm going to give you $10,000 to do a sketch that might take you 2 days, you know?
Do it.
And our last bit of news from DC Comics, they revealed their NYCC panels, exclusives, and how they continue to celebrate 100 years. They started that in San Diego Comic Con earlier this year. They've got some pretty cool panels. Number one on everyone's Oh My Glob. There's a Vertigo panel. What?
It's just my face just on the floor, just shocked.
7 years ago, I was at my first San Diego Comic Con covering it for AIPT, and they announced DC Vertigo, and everyone was like, yay, they're going to put all this effort into it. And then they launched like cool, like six different series or something, or they at least announced them. Some of them went over to Ahoy.
Yeah.
And then somebody at the big wig said, hey, I don't think Vertigo's good. Let's just do DC
Vertigo. I hate Vertigo.
And literally every single comic fan between the ages of like 30 and like 80 were like, Vertigo was like a temple. How dare you? So I'm glad to see it back. I mean, it's already back too, technically, but I'm glad they're putting more effort into it.
Yeah, putting an actual bit of force into it. I also really think that, I know that San Diego is usually the bigger fest, but I think, I feel like with New York, DC always does something kind of interesting or cool. I think they show up a little more in some regard, just because I think that con is maybe a little more for like comics fans specifically, as opposed to SDCC being more kind of pop culture. So I think the Vertigo is proof that, you know, New York Comic Con and DC are melding.
This Vertigo panel is their first panel of the week on Thursday, October 9th. Then they're going to have a Gotham City panel, which of course will keep us up to date on what Matt Fraction, Jorge Jimenez, and others are doing. There's a Jim Lee and Friends panel. Always has one surprise. That panel's cool too, because Jim Lee literally sits there, draws one sketch during the whole panel.
Yeah, if you've seen Jim Lee do any of these panels, it's literally just him talking for an hour or so and like painfully, wonderfully drawing, you know, Batman or Joker. I saw him and he was doing Joker and I was just like, I can't hear what you say because I'm just watching you work and it's amazing.
And then like, I think it was a year ago, might be 2 years ago now, it all blends together, Todd McFarlane showed up and was like, we're doing Batman Spawn! So that'll be good. DC KOs on Saturday. That, of course, will give us lots of new details on the upcoming event. And then there's a BatFam sneak peek screening for Merry Little Batman, which looks delightful.
It does.
Any Hoosiers, that's the news. Let's move on to our next segment. Top books of the week, our top two favorite comics out this week. Can I go first?
Do you want to go first? Interested in going first?
God, you always make me do the work. I really liked Ultra Wild, an audacious plan for rewilding every city on Earth by Steve Mushin. So I got a hard copy of this. I have to say that because a digital copy wouldn't do this justice. It is extra sized.
Yeah.
It is filled with incredible designs. And it's a comic book in its own right, too. Basically, this is a book about how, in order to reverse global warming, first we have to, of course, stop putting fossil fuels into the air. That's a hard one.
Good luck.
He skips that, though, because he's like, let's pretend we could do that. Now it's about putting more, taking the carbon dioxide out of the air. And the book's whole focus is, how do we turn cities into jungles? And it starts out by talking about how, you know, millions of years ago, there were more animals and there were bigger animals. And there was a lot more oxygen. And that means two things. There was a lot more poop coming out of animals, and then there was a lot of animals tilling that land with their body mass. So we don't have that now. So he comes up with these crazy inventions, and each chapter builds on the next, on how do you, he shows you how like a poop cannon could work, and then getting forests to grow up the side of buildings, and creating ecosystems for animals in certain areas, creating bike lanes for people to ride their bikes. It's all really cool and big, and it fully admits, you know, a lot of this doesn't seem possible, but that's the point. Because if you dream up the impossible, you can inspire others to go, hey, well, that's crazy, but maybe we could do this. And it really feels like a tome that for younger readers who might feel hopeless or just love science will read this, get inspired. They're not going to just start blowing things up, but they're going to start thinking outside the box. And that's kind of what this book's about.
Yeah. I got to see a few pages online. I really hope I can get a physical copy, because, like you said, I think that's the only way to experience this book. And it made me think of many years ago, there was a book by a journalist named Alan Weisman called The World Without Us that was basically just about what would happen to the planet if, you know, human beings suddenly disappeared. Mm-hmm. And tonally, it's kind of the same thing. Obviously, this one, Ultra Wild, is, you know, geared more towards, you know, middle schoolers, maybe even high schoolers, but just that idea of like giving people something really like important and significant to chew on, and doing something kind of interesting and novel, and then just adding the fact that it's just this absolutely beautiful book is super great. So I want my own copy. I'm gonna reach across the screen and grab Dave's.
Do you see how much text is on that screen? And yet it's easy to read. And then also look how he like plays around with layout.
Yeah,
there's some creative stuff that he's doing in this book that's really neat.
Yeah, it's creative, but it's also, I think there's just some really interesting theories, and just kind of the way he thinks about climate change right now feels really cool.
There is a chapter to the end, so he's not deluded. There is a chapter to the end where it's all cast in black, and it's like, okay, so since I started writing this book, no one's stopping the fossil fuels. If anything, they're increasing the fossil fuels, and it gets a little doom and gloom. So it's not just, hey, we could save the world. Yay. It is serious.
Yeah, it's definitely, I got that kind of tone of this is a big issue. And yeah, I think he does a really good job of what I've seen of trying to cover this in an earnest way.
You know what I want to see as far as covering something in an earnest way? Your second pick.
Wow. That was, I don't know if I like that.
Tradition. I just like to use your words against you.
6.6 out of 10.
All right.
My second pick was Tex Arcanum number 2. You know, we talked earlier about kind of Vertigo being a temple for readers of a certain age. And I feel like this book kind of touches on that. I mean, it's basically, it's a familiar enough story of kind of grizzled cowboy cop, park ranger kind of guy. You know, goes around the country solving supernatural crimes, kind of like I don't know. It's like a more kind of rural John Constantine in a way. But I love, you know, Christopher Monfitt writes really great kind of dialogue, and he's got a really interesting kind of overarching story, and the way that he kind of plays around with history and folklore and using that to kind of expand on some of these traditions and some of these stories. And you know, Miguel Martos's art is just really great, and it's creepy and weird and bloody, but also kind of like capture something oddly beautiful about these rural places, you know, these kind of like backwaters type towns and other places that are, you know, people don't really give a lot of thought to. And it's just such a great book, and I love it. And, you know, again, it feels a little maybe familiar, you know, the Constantine reference really rings true, but it's just done so well, and I really hope this thing, you know, gets beyond its kind of 4-issue run. I could see this thing being like a really solid ongoing.
If you don't like the idea of things coming out of faces, don't read this comic.
do not do it.
This is interesting. I'm starting to see, like, you like these like very like gritty Americana kind of detective stories.
Give me some, yeah. Give me a handsome, gritty guy and some monsters and you know, lots of American suffering, and I'm on board.
There you go. Nice pick. For my first pick, my favorite comic of the week, I went with
Numero Uno.
I love how I'm like always the superhero nerd, and you're always like, I like this thing that's super smart and only intelligent people like me would like, not like you do. I like the guy in red. He's Spider-Man.
Your number one pick is smart. This is a smart superhero story.
I liked Amazing Spider-Man number 11. Wait a minute. I mean number 975, legacy numbering. So as a milestone issue, I don't know if 975 is really a milestone number, but...
Is it? It's close enough.
Extra-sized. We basically get two comics and some backups in this, so I definitely think it's worth the price, even though it is a little expensive. It's a little more...
Yeah. Money.
But basically we have... John Romita Jr. drawing the first story, which sort of spins out of the cliffhanger of last issue, which was Peter Parker face-to-face with Spider-Man, and they both don't know who each other is. We get a full explanation of that. I won't spoil it here. I think it works. I saw some people, when it got spoiled on Monday, how they were angry about who Spider-Man is. It's like, ooh, everyone takes their turn being Spider-Man. But, you know, given how they've been treating this character for the last 5 years, I think it's a nice... little extra wrinkle on his arc. And I'm glad to see the Peter Parker character return. And this story also kind of brings in this new supervillain that they've introduced, who's some sort of doctor. But then the second part of this issue is Pepe Larraz, like I said last week, baby, he's so freaking good. Art is so insane. He has this yellow cosmic suit that is introduced. We find out Peter... after he fought Hellgate, was sent to some planet which barely has any water or food to eat, be it space rats. And he is rescued by this alien who likes to write books, who has a dark side that is revealed. So when I was reading this book, I kept thinking, like, Joe Kelly, the writer of both these stories, is not holding back. Like, there's stuff in here that I could have seen another writer do over 3 issues or even 6 issues. So it's really satisfying. There's a lot of satisfying twists and turns. And there's also a couple backups. We've got another story featuring Rapid, which was a character Chip Zdarsky co-created. Saladin Ahmed and Perry Perez take over. I love the character. I think his powers are really neat. And it's tied very much to a character who has his faults and tries to do his best like Spider-Man. So it kind of suits being in a book like this. And then there's a fun comic strippy tale by Lee Gatlin where Spider-Man makes his webs taste like mayonnaise. I mean, enough said.
What, that or marshmallow fluff? The only thing that makes sense to me.
And then Jason Liu does a cool little double page splash story that's fun. It's just a lot of bang for your buck in this. And I am just really excited for what Joe Kelly is doing. He continues to do these flashbacks too, which add a lot of richness to the character himself. And I mean, Spider-Man in space. Let's go, baby.
I do want to maybe just add quickly, because I think everything you said is right. But I love the flashbacks. I think they're getting better and better. I love the backups. Like, if you didn't want to read the main story, which for whatever reason, like, I think the backups alone are probably worth the price. I think they're just that kind of entertaining. And yeah, I think there's a fight scene kind of early on in the first story between the spiders. Peter Parker and Spider-Man, that I think is just works really well. And I think it fits kind of the theme that they're trying to explore of, you know, who is Spider-Man? What does he stand for? And just larger questions, I think, about identity as it relates to, you know, the spider canon.
And what an homage to the Clone Saga. I mean,
yes,
I think Peter's wearing the same freaking clothes as he did in the 90s, which, of course, is, you know, my childhood. So, of course,
yeah,
that too.
It's a really, really solid issue.
You know, it is a solid issue, though. Your number one pick. I love the art in this book. It's so cool. And we have a review from Nathan. He also loved it.
Yes, Simmons. Everybody that I've seen has loved this book. It's Blood Honey number one by Sean Peacock. The thing about, I read a review and someone was like, this is basically like a Tim Burton if he did a comic book, which I think is true. I think it works. You know, you pretty much just have these two kind of star-crossed lovers at this kind of duelists high school and they decide that they don't want to be together anymore. And what happens when, you know, young love erupts violently. And it's just such a really great, well done story. I think it, you know, it's great for, like, I think older audiences, because I think you'll appreciate that. But I could see somebody who's like 15, 16 reading this book and being like, I also feel that strongly and that intently. And so that storyline wise, it's great. And I think it's just, you know, Peacock's art is just really, really good. I mean, the layouts, the way that he approaches things, kind of the stylized, slightly 50s-esque, you know, like pulpy style that he uses is great. There's lots of awesome duels. There's some intricate setups for different kind of scenes and shots, and kind of just the way he approaches the fights themselves, in addition to just being really satisfying, are kind of inventive enough. And I can't really say enough nice, like, nobody, no review or no comment that I've seen has had anything to, like, say poorly about this, because I think it's just like one of those things that kind of came out of nowhere and that just kind of checks everybody boxes for, like, if you want a romance comic, this is really satisfying, but I think it's also really, like, thoughtful about how it approaches, you know, kind of human relationships. Great action. It just looks beautiful. Like, it's just such a great, great book. And I want more just kind of random one-shots like these.
Yeah, the satisfying one-shot that's a complete tale.
Yeah.
Also by IDW Darks, so that's cool too.
Yeah.
They're fleshing out their, like, horror adult line.
Yeah.
I agree with Nathan Simmons' review too. He compared it to Heathers and Wednesday.
Yes, yes.
Wednesday's show that Copeland was telling me he loves right before
we started. I'm in love. I got a Wednesday tattoo on my forehead. Know, you can't see it.
It's the bangs that she has.
If you sign up, it's just the line of bangs. So that's it. It's not actual bangs.
If you sign up for a Patreon, you can see a picture of it.
You can see my tattoo.
That's a lot. Moving on to our next segment, Standout.
Kapow!
Moment of the week. I'm going to let you go first because you were just on this topic.
Speaking of Blood Honey, I went back and forth because I think there's just so many shots and so many panels that it could have done. But something about this, which is just sort of these characters interacting, having a conversation. There's a couple of different kind of conversations going on. But we sort of see the layout of their school, and we see somebody kind of moving between it, having these conversations, getting to kind of, you know, the next bullet point. And to me, I think what works with this page is that you can just kind of see, like, how Sean Peacock kind of approaches the scene. Like, I think he could have just kept the conversations, but I think he wanted to kind of maybe bring us into the world a little and show kind of the detail and the depths and just how serious I think that he takes, you know, the building of this world and maintaining it and showing kind of its, you know, personality and, you know, the gothic energies, the kind of the old school vibes a little. And that, I think, translates over to the story proper, that it's, you know, being told by somebody who clearly cares about these characters, has put a lot of thought and energy into it. And what we get feels incredibly fleshed out on every level. And, you know, it's just such a cool, cool book.
Yeah, you could see this double page splash on amptcomics.com. The dashed line making you draw your eye around the way they're going around. It's so cool. And I love the little cat on the bottom right. That's fun. My favorite panel, or so actually this is the full page. It comes from Cruel Universe 2, number 2, by Riley Rossmo and David Walgoss. This is from the first story in the anthology, and it gives away the cliffhanger, spoilers, but kind of a rednecky guy has captured an alien, and he's going to show this journalist so he can get the word out. It turns out, I'm going to just spoil the whole story. It turns out the journalist is an alien, and the alien's like, you want to see, and then the alien discovers that the alien he captured, who was his friend, he cut up the alien into pieces. So the alien's like, all right, we came here for peace, but I can cut you up too, bitch. And Rossmo draws, like, a disgusting, like, we're in this, like, alien chamber where space can be seen through the windows. I don't even know if there are glass, but the body part and blood is just, like, gushing out. There's intestines floating around, and he's been made to stay alive while they cut him into pieces. It's grotesque. It's weird. It's everything a sci-fi horror should be.
I everybody should know how I feel about body horror, so this one is great. I also just love that Riley's got such like a very cartoonish, exaggerated style, and so anytime he draws anything with like human suffering or just blood and guts, I feel like it works really well, and it does here. And the whole story is great, even if you're like the ending has been spoiled. Like, I think the rest of it, the lead up is pretty good.
I really like the entire issue too.
Yeah, the whole issue is great, but yeah, this being our first story is a pretty great start.
Moving on to our top books for next week. We're done with this week. Go away next this
Get
week.
Away.
We don't this, like you anymore.
I want more weeks.
Should we do like worst comic of the week and just trash creators and be like, so-and-so writer is a piece of crap for writing this and we hate it.
He should be taken out into a public square and beaten.
Whoa, I was really nervous you were going to go a little further with that one, but you didn't.
I
applaud you for that, my friend.
Yes.
I am looking forward to Absolute Batman number 12. Look at me, freaking superhero Homer, by Scott Snyder and Nick Dragota. This issue follows the disgusting Clayman drawn tale, which I talked to him about, where Bane crushes Batman, but it's all in his mind, or all in the mind of Alfred, I should say. And now we're going to find out what the hell Bane did while Batman was knocked out. And let's just say new villains are created here. I was trying to be like, mysterious
yeah,
with it.
Choose your
like,
words, yeah.
Let's no, just say exactly what happens in it.
Yeah. I mean, you really can't go any other direction than like, yeah, it's there's going to be somebody new.
And it's a bold choice. I'm writing the review for this one. I put like 700 words into like why did they do this and what does it mean? It really had me thinking, which is good for a superhero book like this. But we're also talking about the legacy of Batman, and all our expectations are kind of, you know, with these Ultimate and Absolute books are tried, they're twisted, they're turned. It's just a fun way of looking at things. So yeah, I think it's a really bold way to end. I don't think this is the end of the second story arc yet, but you know, it almost is with issue 12.
I think 11. I mean, this whole obviously Absolute has been great the entire time, but I think with 11, it felt kind of like a bit of a turning point. Like they've got their, they understand what they're trying to do. I think they've got some momentum. They've got, you know, things figured out enough. And so I think that they're kind of moving forward and everything feels more efficient and it hits a little harder than it already did. And so I'm excited to kind of see more villains.
Speaking of villains, what's your most anticipated book out next week?
Mine should come as no surprise, but it's Toxic Crusaders number one from Matt Boers and Tristan Wright. I feel like a broken record talking about Toxic Crusader at this point, because I say the phrase Toxic Avenger or Toxie probably five times a week at this point. But I'm really excited. I loved what kind of Matt did with the first arc of Toxic Avenger, and obviously that kind of spun off into Toxic Avenger Comics, which is, you know, doing a series of one-shots now before it kind of gets into a story proper down the line. And it's all of it together, I think, is just making me reevaluate and rethink kind of what Toxic Avenger really is and what it's about and kind of the possibilities of the character, and going kind of with Crusaders, which was, you know, a cartoon that, you know, took the original, which was kind of very dark and slightly satirical, and turned it into a Saturday morning cartoon. That was interesting. So I'm curious to kind of see what Matt Boers and Tristan Wright do with Crusaders. Is it going to be a fun, silly, kind of slightly, you know, endearing book? Is it going to be a little more dark and gritty? I feel like they're kind of on a roll. Everybody involved with the Toxic stories, the Toxic team, and I think this one's going to be great.
Year of the Toxie.
Toxic for life, baby.
Is it the Toxie? Just Toxie.
You could, whatever's comfortable.
I know you're comfortable with our next segment, Judging by the Cover Junior, because you are the Judging by the Cover Maestro, if you will.
Maestro.
You're the Bradley Cooper of Judging by the Cover.
I'm the
movie reference.
That one went over my head a little. I just know Bradley Cooper.
He wrote and directed a movie called Maestro. Anyway,
that's right.
What is your favorite cover out next week?
Mine is Power Wars 25, number one. by David Mack, the David Mack variant specifically.
The David Mack.
The, you know, I remember kind of reading the Powers the first time as a teenager. God, that makes me feel old. And really enjoying it. I think it's great. I think it's obviously a really important kind of story, and I think it's definitely one of the ones of Brian Michael Bendis's kind of huge bibliography, his many releases. I think this one is my favorite. I think this is him in his peak form. So I'm excited for that. I think that just, you know, the perspective that David Mack takes with this cover just feels like very stylized. It's cool. I mean, we see two characters. There's some you know, iconography about kind of superheroes in there. It's just like one of those covers that I, if I didn't know about Powers and I didn't kind of know what the story was capable of, I would kind of look at this cover and be like, oh, I get it. Like, it's very sleek and mysterious and, you know, maybe kind of slightly sexy, and it's about superheroes, but obviously it's something different. So I think this cover just works really well to remind people kind of, you know, this is what Powers is. It's going to be maybe something different with this kind of, you know, 25th anniversary story. And so it's just such a cool cover to work to go with.
Yeah, it's not, it's cool how he draws the 25 mixed into the
Yeah.
art. It's like layered, and the sort of superhero cutouts are fun
Yeah.
and lighthearted. 10 years ago, March 25th, 2015, I wrote a review for Powers Season 1, Episode 5.
Wow.
I reviewed almost, I think I reviewed the entire series, and it was on,
Jeez.
and it was aired on like the PlayStation Network or
It
something.
was. It was.
Which was so weird. I got screeners. I was so excited because like we didn't used to get screeners like any time. So I was like, oh my God, access. And yeah, that was 10 years ago, and that was the show. So yeah, 25 years, that's crazy.
God, we are old.
My favorite cover is one I knew I was gonna pick when I saw it when it was solicited. It's the Eddie Brock Carnage number 8 by Pete Woods cover. And Eddie Brock's in the Carnage costumes on the hood of a Carnage car. I mean, it's like someone went, okay, Venom can have a horse, Carnage can have a hot rod. So let's do this.
Only seems fair.
The use of like glowing light on the eyes and mouth is really cool. I like how there's kind of like toothy tread on the wheels. And then, of course, it's very kinetic with the flowing tendrils. And then there's awesome, like, kind of blur, speedliney kind of look on the background. It's very eye-catching, and Eddie looks like he's having the time of his life. Which is
There
great because he's been
was,
miserable this entire
yeah,
series.
he's been just pretty much suffering the entire time. There was a toy called the Web Car that was released in like the mid to late 90s. I'm going to make you include a picture of it alongside this cover. It made me think of this. Like, it's a, the toy itself is like a red, if you're looking at it, it's like almost spot on. So, like, I don't think that's what they intended, but it sure made me feel nostalgic. So, I love this cover.
Oh, that's interesting. We have to ask Pete Woods. Is it this one here, the one I just put in the doc?
Let's see. Oh, it sure is. Oh, yeah. And I forget, it has the little, when you move the car back and forth, it has the little wiggly wobbly legs. Yeah.
That's fun. There's nothing wiggly or wobbly about our interview next. Jacob Phillips, Tate Brumbull, join the show to talk about everything dying and dead. It's out now. Go get it in the comic shop. If you haven't yet, tell your friends. It's a good one.
Or you'll be dead and dying without it.
Oh my God, is that a Chris Copeland promise?
Yes, I will come to your house.
Oh my God, that's not a promise, that's a threat. Wow, yee. Anyway, talk to you guys next week. Jacob Phillips, Tate Brumbull, we have Everything Dead and Dying number 1 out September 3rd. Thank you so much for being on the AT Comics podcast.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
We've been big fans of your work at AIPT. I'm sure we've given something you've done in the past year, few years, a 10 out of 10, probably. We tend to review a lot of books, but we don't give out 10s too often. And I would agree, you both have been doing work that is like cutting edge and different and creative in ways that I don't normally see all the time as someone who reads 80 comics a week. But this is your first collaboration together. What drew you both to Everything Dying and Dead, and what made now the right time to tell the story?
It was what drew us together was the power of friendship. Basically, wow. Me and Jake have been friends for like, I don't know, 3 years now.
Yeah.
We knew each other online for a while. I was friends with Chris Condon. Chris was like one of my first kind of comics industry friends. And obviously Jake and Chris, have done a few books together now. And, Jacob came to Toronto for TCAF 1 year, along with Chris and another friend, Julio Anta, and we all just hung out, and that was the first time I met Jake, and we hit it off really well. And even at that time, I remember telling people about the zombie story I wanted to tell.
Oh, nice.
I don't even know if I told you about it, Jake, at that time, but I remember telling our other friend, Sean. So, I mean, there's a lot of friends, so it's just the power of that. But I remember telling Sean about this zombie book. But for some reason, I didn't make a connection of, like, Jake is the perfect artist for this book. Mm. It took, like, a few years later, another friend was like, you don't have an artist yet? Because, like, I don't want to get this wrong because this story means so much to me. And the collaborator, I really care about what the collaborator I bring in on this. And they were like, Jacob Phillips would draw the hell out of this. Mm. And I was like, oh my God, you were so correct. And then I basically immediately reached out to Jake and was like, this is a story I wanted to make for years. Like, would you want to join me on this?
Sitting on an idea for years, did it evolve over time? Maybe you can't say what the butt of the idea was because that might be a spoiler, but yeah.
Well, it's been in my brain since at least 2021. Because this was very much a story response to just the quarantine experience and the COVID pandemic. So it grew out of that. I actually wrote a really early script of the first issue around that time. That's basically the same as this first issue. It's just I got better at my craft over those years. Sure. But it's like the exact same structure of like it starts off with this farmer and his daily routine and kind of peeling away at the mystery as we see that routine kind of repeating itself. Mm. That was always the first issue. And I usually operate that way. Like I know I come up with a story or my take on a character and I know what the first issue is right away. It was the same with with Batgirl. Mm-hmm. I knew what that first issue was. Right away, and the same with my other book, Behold Behemoth. I knew that first issue, and then it developed from that. I basically just wanted to know what this main character's story was, and it was just like asking questions and going from there.
So, for the listeners, how do you describe this book? Because there's a bit of a twist to it, but it's a zombie story about a farmer who goes about his day. You were just saying, mm-hmm. and has a family. And I think an important detail might be he's gay and he lived in a town that may not have accepted him. Mm-hmm. Am I saying this right? Is there anything I'm missing?
No, you got it right. It's like this guy basically had a pretty hard life in a rural town in Canada. And he fought tooth and nail and was a survivor all these years for like this, to have this life that he cherishes so much.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was this town that he might have struggled with growing up in, kind of being this outsider. He didn't have a great relationship with his father. He wasn't accepted for his sexuality. So kind of kept to himself. And then he met someone and fell in love. And then they kind of became their own little unit. And then they weren't allowed to get married. The government was like, you can't do that. But they still stuck together until they were able to get married. And then they fought to adopt a daughter. Basically, all these decades, this man has just like worked so hard to have this life. And finally he has his family and he's like so happy and in love and all of that. Mm-hmm. And then the zombie apocalypse drops on top of all of that and takes it all away. Right. So it's like this, it's the story of this man who can't let go of everything that he had. Mm-hmm. And so he goes day to day, continuing to care for and keeping those zombie loved ones alive, kind of becoming the shepherd of this entire town. And he keeps them fed. As long as they're fed, they kind of stay docile and keep moving on their like muscle memory. Mm-hmm. And then basically the cast of The Walking Dead walks into town and is like, we need resources, we're fighting for humanity. Yeah. And this man's like, it becomes this one man defending zombies from humanity, which is kind of, which is a twist that I had personally never really seen, especially where the protagonist is the character kind of defending zombies.
I love it.
Yeah. So that was kind of the new take that we wanted to explore here.
Jake, you've built a reputation for capturing grit, loneliness, eerie atmosphere, you know, like that Texas blood and New Bern. What visual tone were you aiming for with this one?
Oh, the exact same again. Sadness and but you know, like that, all that stuff, like that's all the interesting stuff for me. It's the character driven stuff, the emotional stuff, which this, you know, the script had in like bucket loads. So it was, I just sort of fell into it and like just sort of running with it. And it, because it's, you know, it's a step away from what I've been doing on those other books. You know, it's got more of the horror element, you know, the sort of gory stuff, which is fun, but it's the bit that I spend my like time, like, you know, actually working at is the emotional stuff and the character stuff. And, you know, you want to, otherwise you need to be invested in Jack's character. Otherwise you're like, why are you doing this? Or what's the point? Right. And that carries the whole story. So it's, that's the stuff that is important to me. And I think it would, and that's what sort of drew me to the story in the first place when Tate, you know, pitched it to me. So yeah, I'm trying to adopt still more of that, you know, that sort of isolation and loneliness, and just being like, you know, trying to capture the difference between his life before and the life after. You know, there's two very distinct, different looks to those parts of the stories. You know, I've been using this sort of ink wash on the sort of flashback and fantasy elements, which sort of stopping it, and Pip colors that like wash in like a sort of like in like these like warm tones, and it's quite different to what we were doing on in sort of the current day stuff. So it's where he's just like tired, and I'm just trying to like, everything is tired, like the house is tired, he is tired,
yes,
the landscape is tired. It's just like he's been working at keeping this, like keeping his head above water kind of thing. And like, and yeah, and now the last straw is walked into town.
The book has been described as The Last of Us meets Yellowstone. And when there's this blending of genres, be it horror, Western, emotional drama, is there a trick to balancing that, or trying to avoid tipping too far into genre cliche?
I think what I've done is kind of taken from each what I think is needed for this story, especially just structurally. It's very much, it's a Western, not in like a very, I don't know, it is kind of in a classical sense, because it is like there's invaders coming into a town, and there's the one sheriff who's like at the standoff protecting the residents of that town. The residents just happen to be zombies. So like that's the horror element. Sorry, my cat.
It happens to me sometimes too.
So it's just, so yeah, I'm kind of pulling from both. I mean, Westerns are like just on their own, like just like the iconic pieces of them. They're just so perfect for great just morality plays, set on like this iconic landscape of like, we've got this rural town, and just we even have like the black hat and the white hat characters. So it's like you, but then playing with that as well and kind of doing some reversals there. So it's kind of using that and then bringing in a lot of the emotional and psychological horror that kind of just comes with this territory, because this is like emotionally devastating, this story. And the idea that he is kind of fighting for these undead corpses who are like, he should be letting go of them. Like, he should not, like, the healthy thing to do would be to mourn and let go of these people, but he refuses to.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the horror comes from just playing with the reader's perception and emotions with regard to that. Cause like I wanted people to be invested in these zombie characters, even though those are not the same characters. That is not who they are, who they were when they were alive. But I wanted to do a very humanist zombie story. Cause I know The Walking Dead kind of touched on a lot of humanizing some zombie characters, especially when we knew them and then they became zombies and you're like, oh no, but that was them. So I wanted to just like humanize these zombies as much as possible, which Jake did so well with like each design, because you kind of see their humanity and who they were before. Like I love in the first issue, there's just like this young mother pushing a stroller and she's still just like pushing that stroller as a zombie. And it's just like, you know, like, I don't know. I want people to imagine like who these people were when they were alive and how it's like so sad that this virus has now like desecrated their bodies in this way. And like, there's still these walking versions of them. So that's kind of what interested me the most about doing this. Cause I never thought I'd write a zombie story until I came up with this one. And this is like the only way I think I could write a zombie story.
Mm. Yeah. Not to mention, Jake, you're doing amazing work zombifying animals as well.
Yeah.
Those are almost more disturbing to me. I think maybe because it's like a slow, like you pull the curtain back because you think it's a regular cow and then it's not.
Yeah, the zombie cow is like the first thing that Tate got me to draw for the only thing that we drew for the pitch is a different version of that first cover of him milking the zombie cow.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of like, yeah, that was the sort of starting point for me, at least that image with the zombie cow, and then we got to revisit it, you know, a bit more fleshed out for the first cover.
The zombie superfans out there need to know: are these fast running zombies? Are these slow, you know, stumbling zombies? What do we got here?
Have we seen them? I think we've seen them run.
We've seen them shuffling. Mm-hmm. We'll see if they get more cardio in than Ooh. That as the book goes along.
Now, you had mentioned this was inspired, you know, due to the pandemic. Are the zombies a metaphor or just simply monsters?
Well, for me personally, I kind of, the image first came to me where it was like this image of this man kind of sitting at the edge of his bed in the dark, and he was surrounded by his undead family.
Ah.
And I could just see the burden that was on his shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, what is that guy's story? Mm-hmm. And like soon after, like the title of the book came to me, and I was like, I immediately knew that this man was continuing to live alongside like so much death and trying to, like, the world had ended, but he was still trying to live his life as if it hadn't. And he couldn't let go of the world as it was before,
mm-hmm.
which I think definitely came out of those pandemic times where I was just like, how do we go on living after all of this? Like those 2 weeks of that original quarantine, like I did those 2 weeks on my own in my apartment.
Oh, geez.
And like, I lost my mind.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And like, I didn't leave the house. I was mm-hmm. just like on my own. So it was just, and then it was just in a response to like seeing so much around the world of how much death there was and how much grief there was.
Right.
And I was just like, how do we move forward in the world after like this just world altering event?
Mm-hmm.
So this book is definitely a response. I know like horror at this point does not need an elevated horror story about grief, because there's so many.
Yeah.
But this is me doing that in a way, but hopefully in a new way that isn't kind of derivative or just is. It's definitely a response to grief and not being able to move on in kind of this dying world.
It's funny, this morning I saw on the top of the horror subreddit, someone posted a question: why is all horror movies these days about trauma and mental health? I'm sick of it. Can't we change it back and do more varied stories? So, guys, do you have an answer for that guy?
Yeah, I think it's just a mirror of where we're all at right now. It's basically
turn on the news and then try not to have trauma.
Yeah, I think also I think it's always been like that.
Mm.
Like that's like a running theme through horror forever.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think you know there are certain themes that run through a lot of stuff. And it's like because it makes the best. You know, I think the other way around is sort of like horror is the best way to explore those themes rather than horror is like the best way. No, like you know, those themes are the best thing to put into a horror film. Mm. I think it.
Huh.
You know, yeah,
that's well said.
Yeah.
This, as we've been talking about, the series explores themes of love, loss, survival. Was there a particular moment or relationship in the book that was especially personal or meaningful for either of you to write and draw?
I think, like, for me, a lot of it is, like, the Jack and Luke relationship, which is, like, the protagonist and his husband. Just because, like, him being, like, a queer man is so integral to his character that, like, I don't know if he would operate or, like, he wouldn't be doing what he's doing unless he had that whole life experience and, like, fought. Because, like, none of this, like, he doesn't take anything of what he had for granted because he had to, the world didn't want him to have any of that, but he fought for it. So now when the world is trying to take it away again through the zombie virus, he's like, I'm not letting the world take it. So I think that was huge. As the series develops, you see his relationship with the town and more of the people in the town. And that those relationships mean a lot to me because I think him growing up, we see how time and the world changed as he grew up. When he was younger, he was very ostracized. But then in the recent, like the years leading up to the zombie apocalypse, like the town actually started accepting him and actually like sticking up for him and fighting for him. And he had friendships in town that started to mean a lot for him. So I just love going into that because it's like being a queer man, like your friendships means like are almost like very much like your found family. Yeah, like you chose them and like they mean so much to you. So like as he grew up, he started creating like his family got larger and larger and larger. Like originally it was just him. He found his husband. They had a daughter. But then eventually the whole town kind of became this extended family for them that protected them. So like talking about that and getting into that stuff is another important one for sure.
Nice.
Yeah, I have nothing good to follow up.
Pass.
I guess I'm most likely the shuffling undead mum.
Okay. Sure.
And you draw Daisy so well. I'm so excited for issue 3. We see a lot of Daisy, and there's some great scenes with her.
Yeah, it turns out drawing like a 5-year-old is incredibly difficult. I think she visually varies in age from like panel to panel.
Mm-hmm.
Like, but then also zombified, so it's not just a 5-year-old girl.
Yeah,
such an easy thing to take you out of a comic when you can tell the artist's having trouble with the kid, and it's like it's just like a giant head and a tiny body, and it's like
kids are hard.
This isn't working.
Yeah, it is hard. It's hard not to make. Well, actually, at least I think the trouble with a lot of the time is that they look creepy, but at least this time they're meant to look creepy.
Yeah,
true. Makes it easier on you. I actually, Jake, I'd like to ask artists, what's something that pops up in a script you're like, I need to tell the writer I can't draw this because I hate drawing this or I can't draw this or whatever?
There's nothing that I won't at least try and draw. But yeah. I don't know. You always find a way, like, if it's a bit that it's like, as long as it's not the central part of the panel, you know, like, you can sort of just half draw it or whatever.
Oh, true.
You know, you can sort of fake it a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I hate drawing, like, traffic. Like, you know, like, lines. I did it. There's, like, an early issue of Texas Blood where there's, like, they're in LA or something before they get to Texas, and it's, like, there's, like, line of traffic. And then I was like, Chris, I'm never doing this again.
You know, it's funny. Just yesterday, Hayden Sherman said they don't like drawing Priuses and minivans. It's just so boring.
Yeah. Like, I don't know, like, the stuff that I'm like, I don't want to draw that is like, you know, sci-fi like techie stuff. But then once you sort of get into that stuff, it's once you figure it out, it can be, it's fine. You know, it's just more difficult. That's why I don't want to do it. Sure, not that, sure. That I don't like it. It's like today's going to go so much slower now that I have to figure out
how exactly. to do it. Yeah, Ryan Stegman told me he doesn't like drawing interiors of baseball stadiums with all the people in chairs. And then Mike Delmondo early this week said he doesn't like drawing horses because they're like, they don't ever look right.
Yeah,
I apologized. I was like, I'm sorry for making you draw a horse. But then I remembered you drew Enfield, and I was like, hey, I got nothing on that.
Yeah, horses I don't mind as much. Like, the thing with horses is you can find loads of reference for them.
Mm-hmm.
And like, actually, when I was drawing Enfield, I pencil in this program called Clip Studio, and you can import 3D models directly into that thing.
Oh, nice. Uh-huh.
So they have like, you know, figures that you can, like posable figures and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I found one for a horse, and you can like adjust like what point in the run it is and all that sort of
stuff. Oh, wow.
So I literally just traced over that for like the entirety of Enfield. That's all I did. So it makes it way easier. I couldn't draw a horse out of my head.
Like, well, that's the funny thing too, right? Like, it's like a fun party game. Draw a horse from memory, and everybody's gonna draw like a dog.
Yeah.
Tate, this marks your Image Comics debut. What freedoms or challenges did working at Image bring compared to your previous work at DC or Boom?
I think part of it was just the pressure of it being an Image debut, because I was like, I've always wanted to have an Image comic. It hadn't worked out up until this point. And also the fact that the biggest zombie comic ever came out of Image. Sure. I was like, well, there's some double pressure. So I think those were the biggest things. We're both working with Tiny Onion, James Tynan's kind of production hub for this book. So I'm working with those friends again, and Eric Harburn is the editor of this, who I've worked extensively on at like House of Slaughter, and the other is Something That's Killing the Children books and Behold Behemoth. So it's very similar to working on those books. An Image is just like, the freedom of Image is obviously like no other publisher can really offer that. So mostly it was just like the pressure of this being an Image debut, which like I didn't really overthink too much, but obviously like I want it to be a good debut. So
for sure, yeah.
That's just that.
There's so much legacy there, right?
Yeah, totally.
You guys are working with some amazing variant cover artists. Jake, how did you manage to get Sean Phillips on this?
It's hard to make him not do a cover.
Oh, really? That's cute.
He just offers.
That's awesome.
And then,
do you get a page rate difference like with him, like a family rate?
Yeah, we get free covers.
Oh, that's sad.
I think this time, because Pip, who is coloring the book, colored the cover. So I think he just said like, "Oh, just pay her more."
Oh, that's awesome! What a sweetie.
It's great. And like, getting Charlie on the book as well was obviously. No, great.
Iconic.
Yeah.
Joshua Hickson as well.
Yeah,
that cover is incredible.
Yeah, so cool. Yeah, we've got some good ones coming in on the future issues as well. Like, that's like the fun, that's such a fun part of, I think, of doing these like Image books where you can, because we choose, you know, who gets to do it.
Yeah.
It's like playing editor or playing art director for a day. And it's like, oh, what a cool thing to like get these artists that you love to play in your world for a little bit, and like with these characters, you know, it's like, it's like getting a commission, but it's your own thing that's, you know, used for something. It's always
Because you have to give them direction, right?
Yeah, it's like, it's interesting to know what what they gravitate towards within the book as well. Because they'll think of things that, you know, you didn't even consider.
Yeah,
sure.
Like for that Josh Hickson cover, I think he gave like three ideas, and one was at like the dinner table scene. One was Jack kind of at work on his tractor, and then he was like, "And here's like this one. Like, I don't know if you guys will like it, but I really like the heart of this book. So like, I just wanted a cover of like Jack hugging like the one, like Luke zombie, like the zombie Luke. And we were, all of us were like, that's the one. You could just tell, like, that's the one that he loved the most. And, like, we were like, that's the heart of the book right there. Like, it's him hugging a zombie. And he just, like, it's cool to see these artists immediately connect with, like, these different things. So,
For sure. Yeah, it shows it's working, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, you only have 5 issues. And I say only because I like the first issue so much. Maybe we could get 12. But how are you approaching pacing and world building to ensure it still hits that emotional thematic weight in 5?
Yeah, what's been the fun challenge for me is like keeping surprises throughout the book. Mm. Issue 2 will come out and it kind of sets up a new format moving forward of kind of like how the flashbacks will operate.
Mm-hmm.
And then just so we can keep seeing kind of Jack's life before. And with these characters, especially. And then issue 4, again, I was like, okay, I'm tired of that format. Let's switch it up again and keep playing with it in new ways. And like, it'll cater towards whatever that issue needs or what the story needs. But, it's always going to be about just Jack and his relationship with these characters, if these like zombies and who they were before. And revealing more and more of their relationships, because that's the heart of the book is times early on when I was outlining this book, I kept trying to get into more like typical like zombie story stereotypes or things like that, and Eric was like, you don't need to do those things, like you need to focus on like what makes your book like special, like don't worry about hitting like every zombie trope. Cause like we've seen all those, like just like you're telling this story that happens to have undead characters, like tell that story. And whatever tells that way, that story the best. So it's, I think just focusing on what makes this story unique, especially in like the grand scope of the zombie canon. Nice. Yeah.
Also, I think even though it's only 5 issues, I think we've already done 80 pages I've just drawn the third issue and we're on it like 80 pages. They're pretty chunky issues.
Oh, that's great. Yeah,
that's the other thing about Image. We're like, this issue actually needs 10 more pages. And we're doing that.
That's sick. If you had to live with one undead pop culture character, be it a zombie, vampire, ghost, whatever, who would it be and why?
Like, are they a brain-eating zombie or just, like, a reanimated version of themselves?
It's up to you. You're the creator. But just,
if they are trying to eat me, probably someone, like, tiny and feeble.
Mm. Good thought.
But if they're just, like, hanging out, I don't know.
For some reason, my brain immediately went to zombie Muppets.
So. Oh, yeah.
We need a zombie Muppet.
They don't have sharp teeth. You're right. That's a good thought. They're just gnawing at you. I mean, it might be hard to go to sleep at night, but...
Yeah, or like zombie Miss Piggy would be wild.
That's funny.
Yeah, I don't know. That's too hard. I don't know. I'm trying to think of someone I just want to like hang out with.
Mm. Yeah, maybe like a ghost and they're like from so long ago. They have lots of stories to tell you.
Yeah. But then if they're a zombie, they're just, like, groaning.
Mm, yeah, that's true. That's not much of a conversationalist.
No. Like, I could get Elvis in, but then, like, does he still have it at this point, you know?
Oh, yeah. Maybe he's just depressed all the time. God, you're such a downer zombie, Elvis.
Yeah.
I was the king!
And now I'm nothing.
Well, before we wrap up, is there any other books you guys want to... plug or any websites, socials, anything like that?
I have the Megalopolis graphic novel adaptation of the infamous Coppola movie coming out in
this
October.
One right here?
No, there you go.
Whoa.
See, I've not even got that. I've not seen it.
It's a free uncorrected proof, it says.
Yeah, I've got them on the way, apparently. I emailed Chris Ryle and said, can I have some of those?
Nice.
So that's coming out in October, so if you're at all interested, you can pick that up. And then yeah, old books, Texas Blood, Enfield, Newburn.
Mm-hmm.
That's about it. Yeah,
Yeah, my yeah, I've got, if you want more horror stuff, I've got my first ever creator-owned book, which is called Behold Behemoth, and it came out of Boom Studios, which was like another apocalyptic horror, which apparently has become my thing. But it, that one's much more epic in scale, with like kaijus and heaven and hell at war, but also very emotional, with just like this pairing of a young girl and this man at the end of the world. My book, The Oddly Pedestrian Life of Christopher Chaos, both the first two volumes are out for that, which is like a very Buffy-esque meets Doom Patrol or Invincible, where it's just weirdo monsters trying to survive high school and the monster hunters trying to kill them. And the new volume of that started at Dark Horse as well, which is subtitled Children of the Night. So you can check those out if you want more horror stuff. Otherwise, FOC, I don't know when this podcast is coming out, but FOC for Everything Then Dying is August 11th, a Monday. And then it's on sale September 3rd, mm-hmm. the first Wednesday in September. So you can pick it up then.
Nice. And Batgirl, which AIPT loves dearly, is also coming out still.
Yeah, I've got my DC stuff as well.
Busy guy. Ongoing.
Yeah, Green Lantern Dark, my Elseworlds book at DC, which I love. Another horror book, another apocalyptic horror book, but with the iconic Green Lantern, a new Green Lantern I came up with. I love that book very much. That's wrapping up soon, but you can check that out.
Nice. Well, guys, thanks so much for chatting with me. This is really enlightening, and Everything Dead and Dying is definitely worth a purchase, especially since it's coming out right in time for that Halloween season.
Yeah.